So Dorset is where you grew up and it's where you now reside?
That's correct, yeah.
Is that farm country? Is that a rural area?
Very much so. Though, like so much beautiful rural England, it's threatened by suburbia and motorways and general kind of sprawl. But it's so far, it's not too bad. And it's refreshes the soul.
How would you describe the Dorset accent? I've heard so much about that.
Well, you have to be a farmer to understand that.
That's beautiful. That's a genuine, unique accent, would you say, in the UK?
Well, you know, the further you go west and southwest in England, the broader it becomes. And, of course, you know, that's where so many of the immigrants to your country came from. I mean, you're starting with the Mayflower. So there is a correlation between West Country speech and a certain type of American accent.
So the authentic Hausmann portrait was in your house, and you passed it every day.
Well, that's a strange story. I mean, it was completely by happenstance that a friend of my father's, who was a refugee from Breslau in Silesia, before the Anschluss, he decided to get out, and a good job that he did in 1936, and he bicycled from Silesia to Dorset, and in his rucksack he had a guitar and the famous Hausmann portrait, which his great-great-grandfather had bought in a junk shop in Breslau in the 1820s. And he said to my dad, look, with the war coming, would you look after it for him? And he did, and it hung on the first floor landing, and I passed it every day of my life till I was 10 years old.
So what effect did this painting have on you?
Well, I used to have difficulty because it's quite an intimidating, for a kid anyway, it's quite an intimidating portrait, this bewigged, jowly, intent-looking cantor, looks more like a sort of prosperous German politician than anything else. And then the music that I was learning of his as a treble and as a violinist, which was full of life and joy and exuberance, and I couldn't connect the two. It just seemed to me totally opposite. And it's taken really, in a way, it's taken most of my life to and certainly the writing of this book, to attempt a reconciliation between these two visions of the man and his music. And looking at it again, I just saw much greater humanity in it. And if you, it helps if you divide the face in half, and you see the eyes being that of a very intent, pedagogical figure, deeply serious and perhaps a bit introverted. But if you look at the lower half of his face, from the nose to his chin, you see much more of a human, almost a bon viveur, somebody who really enjoys the pleasures of life. And that is the essential dichotomy in Bach, I think, between the human and the superhuman, the intellectual and the sensual.
It always looks like a scowl to me. Maybe I feel guilty about not living up to Bach's expectations.
Yeah, something. Well, it does have that effect. I agree. I mean, I think it's actually, he's just short-sighted. I think he's just myopic. But it comes over as a bit of a scowl and intimidating.
So what did you learn about Bach the man?
Well, it's tricky because compared to pretty well any other composer of the last 400 or 500 years, there is so little to go on that's really factual and accurate. He left so few personal letters. Most of the letters that he wrote were to do with assessing organs, church organs, or recommendations for pupils, or complaints to the municipality that he was being badly treated. Well, there's only very occasionally that you get flashes of real insight into how his mind operated and the beating heart of the man, as it were. And that led me to really look at again at the source material, which has been conveniently airbrushed out of his biography by many writers. And it led me to uncover some pretty unsavory facts about his schooling. I mean, we know very little directly. We know that he played truant. He was absent from school a heck of a lot in his first 4 or 5 years. But what we do also know is that the conditions in the school of the schools of the time were very, very unconducive to learning. I mean, there was a kind of culture of thuggery and hooliganism, and as well as the usual things like an overcrowding in classes, shortage of textbooks, all that sort of stuff.
So he was a survivor. Can we say
that?
Yeah,
he was a survivor. He had to survive, first of all, being an orphan. How are we to really assess what damage to his psyche or what real scars were left by that? That's the first thing. And then death was ubiquitous, always round in his life. I mean, famously, of the 23 children that were born to him and his two wives, 10 of them died before the age of 3. And then he lost his first wife, Maria Barbara, on the only trip he made outside Germany to Bohemia. He came back and found that she'd already been buried. I mean, it goes on and on and on, and he deals with it in an extraordinary way, because you'd imagine, therefore, that the music for grieving and for sorrow would be lacrimose and really depressing, and he does the opposite. His music on the subject of death, and there are many cantatas and motets on that subject, are full of joy, full of hope, full of comfort and solace. And that's remarkable. And it's, in a way, it's symptomatic of this sort of contradiction or paradox between Bach, the good card-carrying Lutheran who does everything according to the book, and then this kind of much more irregular, subversive, sometimes angry man who could pour out his invective in some of his church cantatas with tremendous vigor and point, edge even, and yet find a reconciliation.
Was he a man of true faith, you feel?
Oh, unquestionably. Unquestionably. On the other hand, I think there's also signs that he struggled at times in his life with his faith, that he didn't just take it all completely at face value, that there's certain moments in the cantatas when you feel he understands those of us who really have difficulty in coming to terms with the big eternal philosophical problems. And he finds a compassion and a guide to getting out of those thorny mazes of problems. I think what baffled him, and it comes out in this one letter that he writes to a school classmate called Georg Erdmann in 1736, and he says, you know, I'm surrounded by hindrance and vexation,
yeah,
and the authorities have very little interest in music. They put all sorts of obstacles in his path, and I think that this vexation and hindrance could have shaken his faith temporarily, certainly his faith in human nature.
Did Bach recognize his own genius?
It's difficult to say. Yes, in some ways. I mean, he wouldn't have formulated as such. He would have just said, you know, I worked hard. Anybody who works as hard as I can, as I did, can achieve the same result, which is an unsatisfactory formulation. I think he was very assured in some ways. And little signs of that come in the way that he taught. Those were documents only been recently discovered in the last 4 or 5 years of him sitting down, maybe in a cafe or a beer keller, a drinks place, with his eldest son, Wilhelm Friedemann. And they're both looking at fugue subjects. And you can tell from the manuscript which is Johann Sebastian and which is Wilhelm Friedemann. And Friedemann starts off, and he comes up with a fugue and then suggests a counter subject. And Bach then very gently suggests a different counter subject, which evidently works far better. So then you have Wilhelm Friedemann carrying it on, following what his father does. And he's a grown-up at this stage. He's a fully professional musician. He's not just a student. And then it goes on, and you can see how there's a conversation between the two of them, but Bach's, Johann Sebastian's mind is just in a different league from his son's. That's fascinating. And yet the evidence is that he was very humble in other ways and very collegial towards people in the same profession. According to Carl Philipp Emanuel, his second son, The Bach house in Leipzig was like a dovecot. It was always full of activity and composers and musicians who were coming through town, coming to pay their respects and playing music with the master, and Bach being convivial and host-like and not at all condescending, and a really, really good family man in that sense. So there's that side to him that you have to need to balance with the, you know, irate, entrenched, combative guy who felt that the whole world was trying to rubbish him.
Well, Sir John Elliott Gardiner, thank you so much for your time, and this has been a great, great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the interview. I enjoyed talking to you.